Unity, the strength and assured success all for one and one for all. Unity means solidarity. Yeah. United we stand, divided we fall.
Hello, everybody. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting edition of the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com and, incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com, proudly broadcasting live from the fabulous, chained nation full of islands called New Zealand in the South Pacific, which is incidentally now glowing green and irradiated. My very special guest, joining us live from this fabulous country, our Kiwi collaborator for today, is Christina Stroud. And we're going to be talking a little bit about drugs. And don't get too excited, but she's going to divulge some things that I'm sure all of us really need to hear. Christina, welcome to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
Thanks, Vinnie. It's a pleasure to be here.
You seem to be knocking around your microphone there. Probably advise against that. Well, if you could, just give us a wee bit of a background about yourself.
Vinnie, I was an executive coach trainer back in 2000 when something happened that changed my life and made me pay attention to what I know now to be the social catastrophe of this century, and that's methamphetamine. My son was at the time coming on to 18, and his teacher, who was well loved and who'd been a kind, simple soul, got involved with something bigger than him. I'd been noticing for, say, 6 months previously and saying things to myself like, I can't put my finger on it, but there's something not right. And now I know that's the catchphrase. When someone's gone beyond help or is needing help. So that significantly changed my life, because the day I went down to the school breaching that protocol we have socially about not getting involved, he'd hung himself the night before. And I know it was, he'd been in trouble, and I also know that if I'd been able to intervene, I could have helped him. So I decided to make it my mission, which I have. So I'm part of the Stop the Supply and Demand of Methamphetamine, otherwise known as P in New Zealand, known in America and England as crystal meth, ice, Tina, tick in South Africa. It's everywhere.
Well, what's the clicking going on there? We can basically hear everything that you do. So, well, let's talk about, where did meth actually come from? How was it invented? Do you know that?
I do know. It was actually invented in China in the 18th century, but picked up again by the Japanese in World War I for their fighter pilots. It's a synthetic drug. It's made fairly easily, and it makes people feel 10 feet tall and bulletproof, which was just the right way for suicide pilots to feel.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've got to make sure that the troops are kept happy, and what better way to do that than to dope them up on drugs that make them psychotic?
That's the truth, and this drug does.
Well, I'm wondering to what extent this kind of exists today. Indeed, I believe US fighter pilots are given amphetamines these days even.
Yes, and there's a bit of a distinction between amphetamine speed and methamphetamine, which is 10 times the potency through the way it's cooked and processed and the additives to it. Yes, speed was legal as a diet pill into the 70s. It's something that's been regarded as, well, it's not as if it's heroin. And it's known in America, methamphetamine this is, as the poor man's cocaine. Much, much cheaper there, but still as destructive.
Well, it seems as though there's got an awful lot of drugs flooding the system at the moment. And in my experience, when you talk about the prohibition laws, when you talk about drug supply, it all links back to police and intelligence agencies in support, essentially. You know, intelligence agencies will ship in the drugs and then they'll use their contacts in local law enforcement to distribute it. And apparently the gangs and all of that kind of stuff and the police are all kind of working together to a certain extent. And have you heard any of this?
I'd like to think in New Zealand we're much more naive when it comes to that, and we can trust our police force with our whole heart. I do understand that 78% of all the methamphetamine trade is commanded by the gangs here.
Well, so to what extent... Oh, go ahead.
I wish to remain a little naive about any complicity. However, I do know that customs declare they get about 10% of what really comes into our nation. And as you know, they're hauling in enormous imports. So I guess it goes to prove again the extent of the problem here.
Well, one thing that really strikes me is that the drugs themselves can do plenty amounts of damage, but the law enforcement mechanisms can do even more damage, you know, because they can be used as an endless justification to take away your rights, to suppress you, and in the case of pharmaceutical drugs, I'm sure that their drugs are actually a lot more dangerous than the illegal ones to a certain extent. But when we talk about New Zealand, I mean, how you were talking about how the New Zealand public would be a bit naive, and in my opinion, I completely disagree with Transparency International that we're the most transparent country on Earth, and in fact, I'd probably wager that we're one of the most corrupt. Except the corruption here isn't the kind of open corruption. Like, you can't bribe a police officer in the street in New Zealand like you can in, say, Bali, for example. But if you are, on the other hand, a prime minister or a high court judge, the chances are you only got there because you were corrupt. All right, and you were given the leg up, and you will follow the lines, and you've probably got a bad sordid past that can be revealed about you if you were to step out of line. And that's my understanding of the New Zealand judiciary. But I'm not sure about your awareness of corruption in the New Zealand legal system and judiciary, but we'll just go along with the crystal meth anyway, because that's positive.
What I would like to bring in here is a sanctioned kind of dichotomy about this. The New Zealand government claims we have a war against tea, which is rather cliched if you ask me. But as far as I can see, police and customs are only doing their jobs. That's what they're paid to do. But what I do see is the enormous anomaly in regards to rehab for people who need it. They may be court-ordered to go to rehab, but the rehab then, which is sanctioned and funded by the government for now 30 years, I'm talking about the big three rehabilitative services in New Zealand, they all advocate a little bit won't hurt and harm reduction. Well, trust me, when it comes to methamphetamine, the client's never going to be ready to go for help, and a little bit does hurt. So why, when the nation declare the war on P, do we then have such a ambivalent, lily-livered, rehashed rhetoric style of recovery, which really isn't? It says it all itself, when you're ready. I constantly am confused about how we can declare one thing on one hand and then do another. So for me, that's the biggest puzzle in relation to actually fighting this problem. And
yeah,
I'm aware that there's a lot of people that will be out there saying, hey, listen, it's an individual's right to do what they want. And you know what? I agree, Vinny. I agree completely. I've never campaigned against a drug before, But what I see with this synthetic chemical drug is that people soon lose their choice, and it's those that come looking for help that aren't getting it that concern me, because we're cementing an enormously tragic future for our children. Because another thing that I know about this drug is it breaks all the rules. And I've heard stories that make your hair stand on end about what grandchildren will do to their grandparents and what mothers will do to their sons. This is the drug that's broken all the rules.
Well, you know, and it's a misunderstood drug to a certain extent. You know, people know it's bad, but they don't know precisely how bad or how it works. For example, the absorption method is different. It doesn't dissolve into the bloodstream as with a lot of drugs. In fact, I'm aware that, or at least been made aware, and I could be wrong, that it absorbs directly into the brain matter, and the drug itself is corrosive, so it literally starts to eat away at your brain.
Yes, and do you want a rundown of what's in it? A typical meth recipe,
yeah,
which you can find almost 1 million on the internet, would be made of sulfuric acid, red phosphorus that comes from matches or the road flares, lithium, iodine, cutting agents, sodium, alcohol, gasoline additive, methyl alcohol, sodium hydroxide, acetone and kitty litter. That's just some of the ingredients that go into a batch of methamphetamine. And of course,
it sounds almost like the nice ingredients you'd expect in a good glass of Coca-Cola.
True, but I don't drink
the Coca-Cola. Except the Coca-Cola is probably more likely to kill you. you know, well, it's like for some reason it's called the devil's drug. Have you heard it called that name?
I certainly have. In fact, I have a book prepared called "Dancing with the Devil: Methamphetamine, Your Dirty Drug." It will be published in about 3 months, I hope. Yes, it is dancing with the devil. It makes people do things they never would. Shall I tell you a short story?
Yeah. And again, we're still hearing all that clicking or something there. So if you're touching anything, I mean, basically you want to try and make yourself sort of sterile or whatever. Try not to move or anything. Just speak.
Okay, sorry about that. So once upon a time, about 9 o'clock in my office, I got a phone call. It was a Saturday night, and it was just starting to get dark. And it was an elderly woman's voice, and she was trembling. And I said, "How can I help?" And she said, "I've just spoken to a neighbor, and she suggested I call you." She said, "I'm terrified. There's people waiting in my driveway. They're going to come in and rob me, and they'll hurt me. I know that." I said, "Well, where are you?" She said, "I'm on the second story, and all the lights are off. You see, my husband's away for the weekend. And these people know that, and they're sitting in the drive, they're waiting for it to get dark, and I haven't turned the lights on because I'm terrified they'll get me." And I said, "Well, all I want you to do is stand up and look out onto the driveway. I need to get me the number plate, and we can call the police." She said, "Oh, I'm too scared." And I said, "No, stand up and go over to the driveway, look down. I want the number plate." She said, "Well, why do you want the number plate?" And I said, "So we can identify them." And she said to me, "But I already know who they are. You see, they've done it before." And I said, "Well, who are they?" She said, "Oh, it's my grandson." And that is a kid who at 15, disenchanted and disoriented and a little bit loose and a bit lonely, and in that typical "I hate my mother, she hates me" stage, got preyed upon by a man in his 50s who was very understanding and gave him something nice. "Hey, this will make you feel better, son." And within a month, that kid was running around stealing flat-screen televisions to order for a gang. And that's the story of a meth user.
Well, that's how they get you. But however, of course, that's the extreme kind of thing. There are people that take meth and function quite perfectly. I mean, the lead singer of Deja Voodoo, for example, is a prominent band here in New Zealand. He's tried it once or twice and says, you know, it just wasn't my drug of choice. So there's those who can try it or use it semi-regularly who don't seem to have this extreme addiction, this extreme effect on their personality. My personal experience, I had a friend who was a meth user, and he didn't smoke it or anything. He shot it right up into his arms. And he was just completely insane. Like, he told me that he had the chief of Auckland's drug squad and Satan locked in his basement with surgical tools to see which one of them would come out on top, you know? And I said, well, bro, how long have they been locked in their basement for? And he says, oh, yeah, I've had them locked in there for 100 years. And I go, well, mate, well, what are they eating? And he says, well, you know, I don't want to open the door because I'm too afraid, so I just feed them pancakes and flounder because it fits under the door. And it's like this absolute psychosis. It's beyond insane. And they got he had this kind of twitching sort of phenomenon, you know, with a leg kind of starts kind of sitting there and just, you know, shuddering. And one time he was sitting in my kitchen, must have been at least 2 meters from the refrigerator with his leg going up and down. And the refrigerator was rocking on its hinges. The china was rattling in the cupboards. It's like...
you know, you have to put a little bit of jest into this. It's pretty serious work, I have to say. And this, I guess, to me, goes back to an individual's right to be part of a trade. And that trade is the supply and demand of meth. Because while they're demanding it, yeah, it'll continue to be available, and that means in New Zealand, 466.
We're going off to break now. I'm sorry about that. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. My very special guest is Christina Stroud from New Zealand. Back in a moment.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know the way it's going to go. 'Cause we can't see the way it's going. It's gonna rain, and I need some cover when it's wild. Rain keeps falling down, it's gonna fall. Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the first hour of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest, Christina Stroud, joins us now via phone because there seemed to be a little bit of a problem with the Skype connection there. Christina, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Oh, that's much better.
Sorry, I've caused you so much distress.
Don't worry. In the fight against the New World Order, there's no such thing as unstressed. Now, continuing on here, we wanted to talk about how exactly are the drugs getting into the country?
Well, they come in large shipments of contact MT, and obviously as we're going further down the track, means and methods are getting more exceptional. But I want to tell you something. The main producer of contact MT is a New Zealand company. Over the last 10 years, they built 15 more factories in China for the sole purpose of producing methamphetamine or contact MT, which then gets turned into mess. I'm just wondering if they think that people are getting the colds and flus 15 times more.
Well,
did you know it was a New Zealand company that does that?
Well, considering all the different things that are being put into our food supply and water supply and air, it wouldn't actually surprise me if the if the amount of colds and flu had gone up by 10,000%. However, something tells me, and as I said before, when it comes to drugs, usually there's some kind of government involvement here. And my suspicion is that the only reason why these companies are producing so much extra more is because they've probably got the go-ahead from some high-up official, secretly, of course, like SIS or something along those lines. I'm fully speculating here, of course.
Yeah.
That they're just like, hey, let's flood this country with drugs to create an awful lot of discord, and that way when people react to having all their stuff stolen by people that are addicted to the drugs that we bought in, we can then pass legislation to take everybody's rights and property away from them.
Well, before I got involved with this drug in relation to recovery from it, in terms of starting a rehab, I would have thought that's really far-fetched and really, really far too much for me to comprehend, but gosh almighty, you see things and you just wonder. It seems to me the world is polarised and dichotomous and crazy things happen. And yet we've got to start finding some reasons for things. I reckon if we declared a war on methamphetamine, it would have been over by now, because I think it would have been easier to control.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think that whenever the government declares a war on something, it's usually against either a phantom or a problem that they've created themselves. You know, war on terror, for example, as was the result of a false flag terrorism attack staged by a known CIA, a known CIA asset known only as Osama bin Laden. So. Mm-hmm. When it comes to any type of draconian measures, as I believe police do have, well, basically, if they're not the creator of the crisis, they're certainly the beneficiary of it. As a result, they get more powers, you know. And it seems to me that the amount of big drug busts or whatever that have been happening haven't increased. In fact, if anything, if they were really fighting a war on methamphetamine, the usage rates would not be skyrocketing, okay? Mm-hmm. They don't actually care, I don't think.
Well, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to agree with you. I'm starting to be madly disillusioned with what's happening currently in our country. I'm just as a bit of a sample, I guess, I got the Google alerts. I've been getting them now for 5 years about methamphetamine. When I first started getting them, they come from globally. When I first started getting them, I'd get maybe 3 or 4 every second day. Now I'm getting 10 every day, at least. So it ain't going away, this problem.
Mm.
In New Zealand, we have a number of things that seem to support meth users, and that is our beneficiary system. All they have to do is go to a doctor and say, oh, I'm depressed. The doctors just don't figure it out, and they'll write a letter saying this person is mentally unwell. And I see people on benefits for years, which really is a small amount of money, but it gives them the freedom to keep doing what they're doing. I'm wondering why that's not... Well, that seems so condoned. And
I don't know.
I don't know that we're taking the correct measures to put an end to it, because I don't know why, but I know that it's simpler than this. And I know also, being that we were one of the newer countries, this drug didn't reach our shores until 15 years ago, and that's the earliest that I know of. And yet, we've still got the biggest problem in the world now. We've actually exceeded what happens in America. So why?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's lost hope. I think it's people thinking, well, what the hell, let's just so what? What's it worth? That's what I think
maybe,
in my recovery.
Maybe, it just seems like I don't know, the war on drugs, goodness knows how long it's been waging, goodness knows how many billions of dollars that we've wasted on it.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, if you've got a war, who's the enemy? Okay? Now, have a look at drug users. Is every single drug user an enemy of the state? The answer is no. But the war on drugs treats every drug user as an enemy of the state.
Mm.
All right?
And
drug users, in my opinion, are no more than ordinary citizens. So, therefore, by extension, a war on drugs is a war on ordinary citizens.
I kind of, when you lay it out like that, I have to agree. However, this is the drug, and this is the only one I campaign on, that has changed the fabric of our nation, because meth activates the central nervous system so that people, while they do have control, don't care what they do. And this is why we get the dreadful gangland-style murders, and our nation changed when this drug appeared. We got more kidnappings and much more gang activity underground. There are scandals in the police force, as there are amongst the doctors. And then there's the retired old bloke of 70, bastion of society, who came out of retirement to open up as chemist and sell a contact NT to gangs. This is a drug that's touched people where no other drug has. You see, most other drugs are a little bit of nirvana seeking, a little bit of insightful, psychedelic tripping. Alcohol's another thing altogether, but people know when they've had too much of that because they vomit in their shoes and fall over. And they stop doing it for a bit if it's got that lot bad. But meth is a drug that tells the brain, keep doing this, I want more, and I want this more than I want anything else. It actually floods the receptors of pleasure. So in other words, you can't gain pleasure from any activity that normally you would have. It replaces every single pleasure-seeking activity you've ever done before. That's the chemical in it.
How exactly does it work on the brain? I mean, in terms of the chemicals itself, what kind of reactions do we see?
Well, as you've likened it to other poison that we ingest and swallow, it has an immediate effect on the neurotransmission of dopamine, which is a pleasure centre of your brain. I always liken it to this. Imagine a river, and imagine that's your brain. Imagine a flood, and there's reeds on the side of that river. And after that first massive flood, there's a lot of reeds bent parallel to the ground. And over weeks, as the ground dries and the banks subside, the reeds start to stand up again, but not all of them will. And that's the very effect meth has on a brain, if you consider dendritic pathway, as the reeds. They get flooded with an enormous amount of dopamine, and they never recover. So therefore, it starts a cycle of, I need more, because I can't function any other way, and it goes on and on and on.
Well, you know, and there's a positive side for it. The best part about being on meth is it's only 12 more sleeps till Christmas.
Yeah, and that's the truth.
Yeah. I mean, this dovetails as well, because my curiosity is in the hallucination aspect of it. You know, people who believe they're seeing things that aren't actually there, believe they're doing things that they aren't actually doing, believe that they are people that they really aren't. And to what extent is this the result of sleep deprivation? Because I know that if you've experienced extreme sleep deprivation before. Trust me, I'm in talk radio and I'm under surveillance by the government. I know all about it.
Oh gosh, does that mean I will be now too?
It's already begun. Now we had.
Sure, that's all right then.
Yeah, I mean, it's whenever I have a personal Skype call with somebody, I just say, okay, you know, you can tell me anything. It's just you, me, and the intelligence agencies listening. Okay. But The main thing is that if people are using methamphetamine and it causes them to be deprived of sleep, does that dovetail together both with the depletion of dopamine and the hallucination brought on by sleep deprivation, which makes it such a which makes people go so crazy?
Yes, it does. It makes people have auditory and visual hallucinations. You see, your body's in that most extreme adrenaline. It's in that, it's at the, your body is constantly at the point where if you were to come across an accident, it's the adrenaline that would let you lift a car off a person. Their bodies are in a heightened state of stress. And with that, if, okay, I'm going to, I work with a group of guys who do safety and security, and we stage a bank robbery. And because everyone isn't expecting it and it's completely acted, they're all sitting around in a workroom environment. Suddenly bank robbers come in, and the whole mission is for them to later on describe what they were wearing and identify them as if they were doing a police report. People's senses shut down when they're stressed. Suddenly they lose touch with reality, and a person who's 6'3" with blonde hair might suddenly become a 4'7" giraffe, who knows? People just don't make any sense when they're stressed. Well, in this case of high stress, that's what people do. They're crazy as they become, as crazy as mad hatters. And I'll get them in the office, and they can't sit, and they've got quirks in their faces, and they'll be repetitively picking at something, and they'll jump up and maybe dance across the room like a chicken at first. Bit of fun. It's always a bit of fun in my office.
Well, you know, it's like, I don't know. You can't look at these people as though they're normal people with rational thought and the ability to take care of themselves. I mean, it's because it's taken hold of them. Now, how exactly do you go about helping somebody off of this? And what is the success rate of rehabilitation? Because I know that the government rehabilitation programs and programs like Alcoholics Anonymous, etc., they have something like a 95% relapse rate. And in my opinion, that's because the programs are designed specifically to get people to relapse so that they, well, basically never wind up going out of the job.
I absolutely agree with you. 100%. My whole mission was to be out of business in 2 years, and that hasn't happened because I'm just one small voice fighting to be heard. I have about 90%, 95% success rate with my clients, where they go from being, some of them cooks, heavy users, where they've actually tried rehab 2 or 3 times before, to being free, and to 2 years later surprising me with a phone call to tell me they've got a little baby, or they've bought a house, or they've got a promotion, or any of the things that actually make us happy as human beings. It's probably a little cheesy sounding, but it's true.
And so we'll be right back. Hold on right there. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, after this break. My very special guest from New Zealand is Christina Stroud. And we're talking about methamphetamine. And it explains an awful lot of how crazy the government is and the media, quite frankly, because they're all on it as well, in my opinion. I could be wrong. We'll be right back.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man.
Welcome
across
back.
The desert, bear, man. I breathe the mountain air.
Welcome back to the show that's all about getting meth out everywhere. It's the Mini Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, methforthekids.com. My very special guest is Christina Stroud, from ChristinaStroud.com, I believe. And we're going into how to actually effectively rehabilitate people off of this drug. Christina, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Please divulge about you. What's different about your methodology, okay? Because the official way to get people off of meth fails 95% of the time. Mm-hmm. And the unofficial way that you're doing it fails 5% of the time. Okay. So it's basically like a chalk and cheese of methodologies here.
Right. I've got a degree in psychology, so I learnt and studied how the brain works, to a small degree, of course. As we have available to us more knowledge now than we ever did before, let me tell you why what the official organisations do that doesn't work, why they advocate reduction of harm. It's an outdated old alcohol premise. So alcohol being completely available, legally sanctioned, and it's not illegal, so, hey, a little bit won't hurt applies to alcohol because it can't be done any other way. That's why they talk about this war against alcohol has never worked, prohibition never works. Of course it doesn't, it's legally sanctioned. So how can it be then that what I do works? Because I take a personal look at what that person was before they started using the drug and what their dreams and hopes were. Because remember, this is the drug that's called the lying lady. She's going to promise you so much and she'll deliver you so little. And people take it at first to be more confident, to be sharper, more focused, which is why it's rampant throughout workplace. In fact, statistically, 63% of full-time users in New Zealand are in full-time employment. That's according to government stats.
Sounds about that right.
It means that it also might explain, and going with the other facts, 80% of all crime in New Zealand heard in the High Court revolve around methamphetamine use. That's 80%. Mm. 80% of all our funding, all our education system is suffering. All of the, which may or may not be a good thing, I agree, the way it is. If meth is behind 80% of all the crime, why hasn't something been done much sooner in terms of helping those people that finally come for help or need help? You see, what happens is people don't get the help they need unless they're stopped by the police. Then they're ordered to court, and then the court orders drug counselling. And more frighteningly is we're going to go to drug courts, which haven't stemmed the problem in America, and yet they're modelled on that. And the reason why they don't work is because, again, ineffective counselling. Okay, Vinnie made a point. Most organisations and institutions, of which they all are, rely on their funding to tick over just the way it is. The more need there is for them, the more needs can be shown for them, means they get more funding. It's as simple as that. So we've got ourselves in a bit of a conundrum here.
So my perspective...
Should be working to be out of business with it real quick. So getting back to what I do that works, first of all, I capture what that person has lost. It's an individual approach. And then we do simple things. Simple things like eating and sleeping. And I guess when you have a zero tolerance for any relapse and you don't have little singy songs and dittos and little rhymed songs that people sing when they relapse in the other places, if you don't expect that as a recovery expert, then it doesn't happen.
With relapses, I mean, what is it that causes somebody to relapse? I mean, let's say they're on the road to recovery and they relapse. What was their motivation to go backwards rather than forwards?
Same environment, a lot of environmental triggers, like, for example, somebody who goes back into the same crowd finds themselves doing the same thing they used to every Friday night. That's where we break a pattern. Basically, it's a good understanding of how the brain works, and we break patterns and break associations, and the client needs to attach a whole lot of pain to the past so that he doesn't want to go there anymore. That's basically the recipe for a successful recovery.
that reminds me of the Netherlands when they decriminalized cannabis and allowed people to basically they could smoke it or not smoke it, whatever. They found that the usage rate went down dramatically. I mean, currently in New Zealand, it's approximately 1 in 8 users of cannabis, and this is just a side issue, but I think it's it holds true to this this theory here. And what happened after it is that it decreased dramatically to 1 in 21, so about a third of the people that used to be smoking when it was illegal continued to smoke. Right, mm-hmm. and so the other two thirds people were questioned. There was a big survey that went round. Why did you stop smoking? And they said, "Well, my social circles changed."
Mm.
Right, and it was because the fact that it wasn't illegal anymore, they didn't have to have friends that their only commonality with was smoking weed.
Mm.
When you're smoking weed together and it's illegal, you usually will stick by those same friends, even though you've got nothing in common with them, because you can at least safely do something illegal together that you both enjoy. And as soon as that air of prohibition dissipates, you find out that people start to become a lot more happy, a lot more healthy, and wind up changing their lifestyle because it's like the whole problem and the reason why there's so much drug abuse is because the drugs are illegal. If they were legal and regulated, then people wouldn't be afraid to go to the authorities to ask for help because they wouldn't be able to be arrested.
And this is a multi-billion dollar industry, and it's well managed by the gangs. You're right. You're right on all the above. But, however, the distinction, again, is that I'll make, is that it doesn't matter how legal it is, meth is still going to make people do the things they do, the terrible, terrible things. What has to happen is we have to have, if we're going to have drug courts, then we have to have effective rehab. No more lily-livered ambivalence, because actually it's what you hold in your head. If you think it's okay, it will be.
Mm-hmm.
So, well,
Go ahead.
One of the more frightening aspects, and it's happening in New Zealand right now, is that the City Mission has got together with the City Council and they're building a block of apartments. They're going to inhabit these. Well, it's a very expensive block. I think it's 160 million or something like 60 million. It's going to be filled with students, single mothers, and it's going to have a 20-bed rehab. You know what? Why are we normalising this? It's going to have a 20-bed rehab, and I'll tell you what, that's going to be full of court-ordered rehabilitation. In other words, anyone who goes to court for doing the things they do, theft, assault, violent assault, all the things they do to get court ordered, those people will be filling up that apartment, and very soon, and it won't take long, every single person in the rest of that apartment block is going to be their prey. Prostituting and students who will carry it for them. Perfect. Couldn't be better. What social planning that is. I'm appalled and going to be putting in some argument against it.
I see. And again, we approach the aspect of naivete, and in my opinion, I operate under a lot of assumptions. I mean, chief assumption being that everything I think I know is in fact wrong. I just haven't seen the evidence as yet. You know, it hasn't been presented to me. So when I think about this sort of planning as that you're talking about, which would inexorably help along the huge amount of people that are currently falling prey to this drug, and as a result falling prey to the police, and as a result falling prey to false to false rehab programs, and as a result, you know, so on and so forth. It's just a big effing snowball effect. You know, who stands to gain from all of that? Well, you've got the drugs. The gangs are selling to everybody. Okay, great. Fabulous profit for the gangs. And also, you manage to get the police budgets up, because there's going to be a heck of a lot more problems with violence and theft and drug-related illnesses, all of that.
Yep.
And on top of that,
the police don't arrest. Over Easter, on Easter Sunday, I had a couple of older parents in their 60s. Their 38-year-old daughter had come in and was beating them up. He's had a heart attack, you know. So they rang the police. The police didn't arrest her. The police said, I'll leave it to you to trespass here, and that's not good enough. But that keeps their statistics down, doesn't it? Because I read for the Whangarei Peninsula, the crime rate's down 11%, but then my friend who works in banks said to me there were six armed robberies up there just for the last month. So yeah. I want to know how these statistics are gathered, and I do know for a fact that there are the police actually hesitate to arrest simple, small events that where that person could get the help that's necessary, but they know it's not effective anyway, so they don't.
Yeah. All right. I'd like to thank you, Christina, for coming on the show with me today. It's been a real pleasure. Do you have a website where if somebody has a loved one, they can come to you to get help?
Yes, you can email me through my website, which is www.christinastroud.com. And if I have concerned anybody or people do need to call me, an email I'll answer. Just please do feel free to do that. Thanks, Vinny.
Thank you very much, and you have yourself a wonderful day. And I hope tonight, unlike many of the people you treat, you can get some nice sleep. All right. There she goes, Christina Stroud, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Coming up in hour number two, we have the fabulous godfather of the truth movement here in New Zealand, Tim Lynch. Back in a moment.